I told you about calling a guy in Chicago who told me that he wanted me to write an inventory. His name was Paul Martin. And Paul at that time had probably about as much sobriety as Bob has now, in his 40s, early 40s of sobriety. Just brief history. He came into AA at 25 years old and died at 87 years old with 62 years of sobriety. And when he made a statement about the program and just about anything else he was talking about, I don't think I ever heard him change his mind. Larry in here was sponsored by Paul for a bit of the same time that we were doing through that. So I had called Paul and I had asked him to help me, and he had me write the inventory. And I had written that whole new inventory again, and not very long, maybe over a weekend, couple more days. And I called him and told him I'd finished it, and he told me to be in LaGrange, Indiana. I guess he told me to be in Riverside, actually, in the same neighborhood, roughly, and told me where there was a motel up in Chicago there, and he wanted me to be there by 4 o'clock on a Friday night. And so I got there just in time to get a room at this motel. There was a gas station across the street, so I went across the street, got a cup of gas station coffee, and got back up into my room, and there was a knock on the door. And I opened the door, and there was a complete stranger there. I'd never seen him before. He's carrying a three-ring binder, and I wish I could really do the Irish accent, but he says, "My name is Dennis O'Brien, and I'm here to swap fifth steps with you." And he walks into the room, and he sits down in the only chair in the room, which still irritates me. And he says, "I'm going to go first chair so you know what to do." And so he opened his binder, and he starts reading an inventory. And I'm listening. And he's talking about a lot of the same stuff that was in my inventory. And I think he said he was 29 years sober at that time. Did I say that? I don't remember. But he had been going through it. And he had been behaving during that time very similar to the way I had been. And like me, he had written lots of inventories. He knew how to write inventory without dealing so much with the drama. Very little bit. So we could get to it fairly quickly. When he completed his fifth step with me, I shared mine with him. We spent a few minutes afterwards comparing notes, because I had picked up some stuff he'd missed, and he'd picked up some stuff I had missed. And he moved on. I went and got another cup of coffee, and I came back, and there's another knock on the door. And this guy's name is Chuck, I think, or Charles. And he was a stockbroker from downtown Chicago. It sounded like he was a thug off the streets. And told me he was there, and he was going to go first, so I'd know what to do. And so the same routine I did with him, and by noon that following Sunday, I had done that same thing with 9 different men at various times. Paul had the most sobriety. He was, like I say, he was in his 40s when he said that. But 2 of the guys that did that had less than 3 years. And I later learned that with less than 3 years, these 2 guys had most of their amends made, including paying back some people they had rooked off on the southwest side of Chicago and owned Greek restaurants. And those are not fun people to deal with if you screwed them over. But they were doing this thing, and they were doing it. And I hadn't really quite seen that even amongst us moving that fast. So my fifth steps were there. They were all swapped, and I heard inventory from those nine guys, and it was all current inventory. Now, we heard a discussion earlier in here today where I was thinking about that, where we were discussing worshiping the steps instead of the maker of the steps, instead of living in the love of this in the Babel and the program here. And so I'm sitting watching these guys, and I'm learning from them. I thought I knew it all at that point, but apparently I didn't, because here's what guys, we're getting this program much quicker and much more, it's much better done, well done than I had in the past. And I'm sitting there watching this, and something's going on with them that it really worked. And if you were ever to pick up anything that you found that Paul Martin has written, Tarek reminds me, Tarek, I love to catch them when they're looking at their iPad. God, I love that. Our next session is going to be on AA courtesy. What do you think? I need your address. I'm going to mail you something after this. In all those cases, all of those had a comment, and it was an interesting comment to me, and I'll share more about that with you later. Many of those guys knew the steps out of the 12 and 12 and not the big book. But it was interesting because when we were swapping inventories, there was very little difference going on. Some of the language is a little different, but if you were paying attention, they were touching on a lot of the same stuff. Now, that may sound like heresy to some of us in here, but it really wasn't. All I'm doing to kind of get you is to soften your attitudes about people who are working the program, because there's long-term sobriety in that group, and it covers probably all of the South 48 states and part of Canada, wouldn't you think, Larry, that... awful lot of people have gotten help out of that group. Many of them were AA members who approached Paul with many years of sobriety, and their choice was suicide, homicide, anything but staying sober. And they were sat down and they were given the same litany that I was given to get involved in this, and a promise it would work. So I did my fifth steps, after Paul left on Saturday night, I was told I was supposed to meet him for lunch or late breakfast at a coffee shop up there. And I was to go ahead and do 6 and 7 before I left. And so they left and went to that meeting. So anyway, I did. I took the book out. I said the seventh step prayer, and I met it. I can't say that it had the impact on me that it had when I did the third step, but it was huge. But what I want to tell you is when I met, not all of them were at that breakfast, but I think four of them were, and we started the discussion after breakfast by saying the seven-step prayer again. And these guys very often would do what I would call a 10-step inventory, or swap inventories briefly and all that. But they would end phone conversations, just talking back and forth to each other, with the seventh-step prayer. It's not a practice I followed necessarily, but it was really helpful. And I can't find anything where that's doing that stuff wrong. It's not doing the program. So if somebody makes a suggestion that maybe you might want to try that, I offered it up as it's been a great experience. For me, I miss talking to those guys too. They all moved on without me. You're up.
I'm kind of a loner. I've got a lot of friends, but I'm not sure I want them. I enjoy my friendships. I really do. But they make me nervous. So I don't seek them. I don't care whether people like me or not. You might have noticed that. And when I started in Alcoholics Anonymous, the only guy that I really let close to me was Don. And I wrote this inventory. It took me like a month and a half to write this thing. And I was a salesman, and I was traveling over the road a lot, and I would get into motels at night, and I would just sit down. I'd get something to eat, and then I'd go in there and sit down and write inventory. Now, my experience before sobriety was full of violence and just despicable behavior. And when I was doing it, it was just business back then, but, you know, when I started developing a social conscience and I started developing a moral compass, and I thought, oh my God, I'm surprised anybody talks to me if they knew where I'd been and what I'd done and all that stuff. So I wrote it all. And what they kept saying to me was, don't leave anything out. And I went, like what? And they go, like you're take it to the grave stuff. And, you know, if somebody says that to me, I know just exactly what they're talking about. It's all the stuff I would never share with anyone under any circumstances because it's too embarrassing. Normally it has something to do with sex, just so you know. And additional information is there's only so many ways you can do that.
Sex?
Yes. And, you know, unless you're on a rocket ship with a laser and a rubber chicken, and it's all been done before. Someone asked me to tell this story. Well, Rich asked me to tell this story. I was at my home group, Happy Way. And there was a new guy in the room, and we were having a meeting on sex inventory. And he started turning red, this guy. So you could tell he absolutely had to say something. And he turned redder and redder, and he looked like at some point he was going to explode. And finally he jumped up in the middle of the meeting, and he said, and if any of you sons of bitches tell me that you haven't done it with a farm animal, I'll call you a fucking liar. We were stunned. My last funny experience with that was we had a young lady in the room, an attractive young lady, and she was talking about how promiscuous she was when she was drinking. And when it got around to me, I said, where the hell were you when I was drinking? And she said, I wasn't born yet. When I wrote that inventory, I put everything in it. I didn't leave anything out. And I knew I had to fist step it with Don. And I didn't want to do it because he was the only person I had let close to me in a long time. You know, eventually got real close with Gary and some other people, but in the beginning, Don was kind of the anchor for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had to sit down and talk about all this despicable stuff I did. And I was certain that as soon as he heard my inventory, he was going to look at me and he was going to say, we need to talk about a couple things. One of them is I don't want you anywhere near my wife or children. I would appreciate it greatly if you wouldn't tell anyone that I'm your sponsor. And I think we're going to have to limit contact in the future. You know, he didn't do that at all. What he did is he got up and hugged me. And he told me that he loved me. See, all that was very difficult for me because I was really protecting my masculinity. And it was just stupid. And anyway, he got up, he hugged me, told me he loved me, and that he was really happy that I had shared all that information. And I thought, once I told him what I'd been through, that he would run out of the room. And what I found out was that as bad as I was, that someone could know exactly what I was, and they would still love me and want to be my friend. That's a hell of a thing to find out. I've done a lot of fist steps, gee whiz. And I do a lot of fist steps with people that I take through the steps. Now, I have to alter that periodically because if you're taking people through the steps, they'll let you get away with stuff while you're fist-stepping with them because they don't want to irritate you or whatever that is, whatever that motivation is. So what I do periodically is I go back to people who are long-timers and tell them I'd like you to listen to my fifth step. I 10-step with Gary. I 10-step a ton, and we'll get to that, but it's something you really ought to pay attention to in the work because it shows you how to get out of yourself. And so it's very important, and we'll talk about that later. But today, my fifth steps are almost embarrassing. I mean, they're just chicken shit. It's little picayune-ish stuff you wouldn't... That's a word down here, isn't it? They're little pedestrian things that we do that we're just embarrassed about. You know, I shouldn't be doing that stuff when I've been sober this long, and I keep telling people I'm trying to live a life that's pleasing to God. Well, that doesn't look like it. So mostly my fifth steps these days are embarrassing. You know, the early ones had all the big stuff in it. Once you've made a decision to live by spiritual principles, fifth steps get embarrassing. So, but you do it anyway because it's about defeating the ego. Now, this doesn't have any, well, I don't even know if I should say this. One of the best ego, Bill Wilson made a big deal out of the ego. And he said that recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is ego deflation at depth. One of the best ways you can defeat the ego is by writing inventory and fifth-stepping it. Also making amends. It's a big ego deflator.
Put up one more before I even talk about it.
Okay. So If you want a good book about the ego, and this shouldn't even come up in a meeting, but Eckhart Tolle wrote a book called The New Earth, and the whole book's about the ego. And he agrees specifically with Bill Wilson in that the ego is the enemy. And see, I know from my own experience that my ego tells me that nothing is ever going to work for me, and I'm too damn stupid to succeed and all that stuff. And people all think that your ego is going to tell you that you're better than you are. I've not met any alcoholics whose ego does that. It always tells them they're worse than they are. And there are two voices in your head, and one's your intuition and one is your ego. And you need to learn how to differentiate between those two voices. The intuition is a quiet, confident voice that tells you you can succeed, and it will always tell you the truth. The ego will invariably lie to you. So it's important to find a way to get rid. You can't kill the ego. You can deflate it, but the problem with the ego is that it's resilient. And if you fail to stay in some sort of spiritual work, the ego will regenerate itself. So it's important to periodically deflate the hell out of it, because it's going to make your life a lot better. Thanks.
I interrupted Bob there. I think, looking around this room, I've got an inventory that I wrote that I found extremely healthy. And I'm talking to mostly the guys in here, as far as I know. There might be some women it applies to. But a number of years ago, I was self-employed, and I was the only earner in my business. And I find myself cutting into some behavior that was preventing to do a lot of things. And so, looking at my life and the way it was going, and I had an office in my upstairs bedroom, Julie was out working, and so I would go in there supposedly to take care of the bookwork and the things I had to do for my business. And I'd find myself looking at pornography. And while this went on for a little while, the more I did it, the more sleazy I felt about myself, the worse I felt about my behavior there and what it was doing. Who is that guy that had the kids' TV show that they caught in a porno? Pee-wee Herman. And I thought, God, I'm no worse than that monkey. Working with this and resenting it and seeming unable to get away from it, and I just kind of gave up this one day, took a pad and pencil out, and I made four columns, and I put that I resented pornography in the first column. And the second column I put, I hated it because it was destroying my sex with my wife, with my family, and just the intimacy in general with Julie, it was interfering with, and it was doing that. It was keeping me from going out and making a living. It was going that way. Primarily, those are the two things. But the third thing it bothered me about is it occupied my mind, no matter where I was or what I was doing. It would interfere with what I was trying to concentrate on, and I was trying to do that. And then I took it to the third column, And you talk about destroying your self-esteem. Just picture yourself standing there like a little kid. Was doing it. It was destroying any of my ambitions. It was destroying any sex relations I had with anything real. Now, having said that, my wife was not aware of that at that time. She's heard this inventory because we've done couples workshops together and that sort of thing, but it's not the most comfortable thing for me to discuss with her when she's around, but she's very much aware of it. So if this is on tape, it's not going to bother her. But the lie we were living around here, around there, it was destroying our relationships and our intimacy. But then they would turn around and there were times I had to use porn to be intimate with my wife. Now there's some real dishonesty in that in there. And as I looked through the fourth column, it was entirely selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightening. And at depth in all of those instances. And I've gotten where I like to bring these up in these situations and be a little more honest. Because I look around the room, and there's a boatload of men in here, and I'll bet you 90% of us in here are messing with pornography. And if you think it's a bad issue and we're going to keep it hush-hush, it's too fucking late. We're trapped. And that's what's happening with it. I have a guy I'm working with who attends the old LaGrange group now. And that, and he's in a relationship. He's going to get married, and he has talked with me about doing this. And so I shared this experience with him, and he said, "You got to be kidding." And I said, "No, I'm not kidding. I found that treating pornography the same way we treat principles and resentments and institutions, it's worked well for me." And so I gave him the same hints I gave you on getting started in doing it. And he called with a fifth step on it, and he nailed it. And he says, "Well, what did you do then?" And I said, "I have two laptops and a cell phone. And as far as I know, any potential way to get pornography in those three devices is blocked." I had physically done that. Now, having known I've done that, I haven't been tempted to do it, even when I'm home alone. What a concept. It's crazy. So I just thought I'd throw that out. When we're talking about going through all of our lives, we're talking about going through every little secret and dirty little slimy thing we think about and do. With that. So just give you a little something else to think about. So now you... Now you understand we inventory principles, old ideas, if you will. How about that for an old idea? Look at some poor girl who's loaded on drugs and doing the drugs and doing pornography to make money to get her next hit. And thinking we're the real Romeo of the world. And looking at that. Look at that lie. This is insanity that we're participating in, and we're not helping anybody. I guess that's enough. Do what you need with that. I got to tell you, I don't like talking about that. The only time I like that one was somebody calls up and says, "Thanks for bringing that up in that meeting. I would never have had guts enough to bring it up with that." So, well, go ahead and start 6 and 7.
I've got kind of a blank mind at the moment. Well, how close are we to dinner? What I can tell you is that 6 and 7 are very important steps to me. And 6 is about having the willingness to be rid of all those things that we found in our inventories. All those defects of character. And one of the things that I found out was that those defects of character that I found in the inventory in the fifth step, to some real degree, were the ways that I protected myself. You know, I've always been real hard to get next to, because of all kinds of irrational fear, and that's why I was a loner. I didn't want to mess with it. And I, from the time I was a small kid, I told you I had that wandering eye and the speech impediment and all that stuff. I developed a personality to drive other people away from me because I didn't want people picking on me. And so I had all sorts of character defects. I mean, I walked around until I think I was 60 years old, just with a look on my face that said, "Don't fuck with me." And yeah, I didn't do it because I did it because I was afraid. And that takes an enormous amount of energy. And I found out that there were so many things that showed up in defects of character that were ways that I protected myself. Now, the next thing that you have to do is say this prayer in the seventh step, where you tell God that he can now accept all of you, good and bad. Except I don't know what's good and what's bad. I've told a number of people in here privately that they had the skills and abilities to become useful to God, uniquely prepared to do God's work in some specific area, and that it's our job to find out what that is. Now, I have been aggressive and standoffish and walking around with this "don't fuck with me" attitude for most of my life. And I've asked God to remove it numerous times. And I have been more than prepared for God to take it. Now, what's the problem with that? The problem is that as soon as I have the ways I protect myself taken away by God in the seventh step, I'm undefended. Now what? If I'm undefended, what the hell's going to happen to me? What if some idiot comes down the road with a bad idea? This is about trusting God, so help me. Am I willing to be rid of all of those things I protect myself with that are defects? Their attitudes, their actions, they're all sorts of things. So we don't get roughed up or mistreated or whatever it is. Am I willing to leave myself undefended? Well, you know what? Try it. See what happens. Leave yourself undefended and find out whether God's really got your back or not. Okay? This is risky business. And putting yourself on the line is this spiritual exercise about whether God's really got your back or not, or whether all of this stuff is just total bullshit. You willing to risk that? See, we've been talking about one right after another here. About, are you willing to put everything on the line? Are you willing to involve yourself in all of these steps that put you at risk? It's a perceived risk. It isn't a real risk. See, we think, well, maybe God's got a bad attitude. And maybe he just wants to hurt me because of all the stuff I did. But see, we have all of these opportunities to trust God, step after step after step. And are you willing to step up and find out whether this thing works or not? I ask God to remove this sort of aggressive attitude and all that other stuff that was going on with it. And I kept wondering why God wouldn't remove it. And some smart ass came up to me and said, it's because you don't want him to remove it. Probably not a good thing to say. And what I found out was that I work with mentally ill inmates. And that kind of attitude really works in a correctional facility. Because, you know, I worked with inmates for the last 20 years. And some of you have heard this before, but they knew I was sentenced to prison before most of them were born for a violent felony. And so when people got out of line, they'd go, hey, it's all right, he's OG. Now, if you haven't been to prison, you probably don't know what OG is. But OG stands for original gangster. So, you know, they go, hey, this son of a bitch was locked up before you were even a smile on your mother's face. And so that's all part of that attitude. And I worked 20 years with extremely dangerous people and never got a scratch and carried a message. You know, my kids think it's... I have 5 sons, and some of them want to take over that business. And I said, y'all went to college, so you don't have to take over that business. And I'm going to close it down because I don't want you in that business. I'll do it to make enough money to get you all through college so you're prepared to go on about your life. And so, frankly, I have enough to retire on. But I don't want you waking up every day knowing you're getting in front of a bunch of people that could kill you for a nickel. Some of the sociopaths that I met in prison were guys who had been gangbangers from the time they were about 12. And they truly would kill you for nothing at all. And I don't mind doing that because I have kind of an odd personality. But I don't want my kids doing that. I want my kids to be lawyers and engineers and all that stuff. And that's what they are. But God can make us useful. You know, in the next 6 months, I'll be completely retired. And I don't have to worry about anything. I mean, God has given me everything I need to be comfortably retired. And all I had to do was trust where he took me. You know, the first 3 times they told me I had to go work with inmates, I had just sold a printing company where I had 125 employees. And I thought I was retired. And this guy said, well, come over and work with inmates. And I went, bullshit. I got enough antisocial people in my life without going out and looking for some. And it turned out to be this wonderful opportunity to not only be of service, but to become financially secure. So, you know, God's taken me down some funny roads, and every once in a while I'll refuse them. And he'll keep putting them in front of me till I take them. Don't you think it'd be fun to have that kind of experience? So my attitude and all that stuff was perfect for that kind of job, to be of service to people who are experiencing incarceration. Good. So that's what I assume. That's why God never took away the kind of aggressive attitude that I've always lived with, because it protected me through that whole experience. Do you know, this is the first time in my life, in my adult life, when I haven't been in dangerous situations for as long. I mean, starting with the military, then going to organized crime, and then going into working with prisoners. And I don't know what to do.
I don't know what it's like in Denver, but walking down the streets in Indianapolis is pretty damn dangerous, too.
Yeah. But I mean, I get up and I don't have to rev up to get in front of people that have the possibility to create problems in my life. So all of a sudden, you know, I hang out with my kids and I do all that stuff, and I don't have to be revved up to defend myself all the time. It's an odd thing, and it's a new experience for me, and I frankly don't even know what to do with it yet. But I keep asking God for guidance, and maybe he's just going to tell me to buy a fishing boat. I don't know. But that chapter of my life has ended. So are you willing to be rid of all of those things that have protected you for all of these years? If they're a character defect, you don't want them. And it's kind of nice not to have to use all the energy to practice them. Right? You want to talk about seven?
Well, it appears to me that you've pretty well covered it. I don't have anything that comes to mind right now, Bob. I really don't. Any comments, questions?
Well, let's talk about the prayer.
Okay.
Let me see if I remember it. It's in the book here. But God, I'm now ready that you have all of me, good and bad. That. Mm-hmm. I now ask that you remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do thy billing. Bidding.
Bidding.
Bidding. Bidding. There's an amen on the end of it.
There is. Yep. Somebody talked about that today. There is no amen at the
end of the third step.
So this must be it.
So let's look at that. God, I'm now ready that you have all of me, good or bad. I can tell you from my own experience that I don't know the difference. See, I always thought the aggressive stuff ought to go away, and God kept it. And I asked him with an absolute willingness to be rid of it. And he kept it there, and it was useful. I suspect that it's not useful anymore. And I just soon not do it anymore. So that some of that stuff becomes habitual. But I don't know what's good and bad. So all I'm saying to God is, make me what you want me. Take the stuff you don't want. Leave any stuff you think is okay, and let's move on. And then it talks about asking God to remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to him and my fellows. What if I'm undefended? Who's going to defend me?
What would usefulness to him be that would be different from being useful to our fellows? It seems to me, if he's going to ask me to be useful, he's going to want me to do something for my fellows or with my fellows.
See, I just think it's trying to live life that's pleasing to God. If I don't think it's pleasing to God, I don't want to do it. What I found out is that God wants me to have fun. God isn't this real dour kind of presence. You know the part in the book about carrying the vision of God's will into all your activities? So every time I would change activities on the days that I would do this, I would virtually make a plan. It would be part of my plan for the day. And part of the plan was to get up and carry the vision of God's will into all my activities. So every time I changed activities, I asked that God be a part of it. With nothing more than God, please be a part of this activity. So I'm almost embarrassed to say this. So my girlfriend was visiting me, and we were going to go have sex. And I said, you think we ought to ask God to be a part of this? I mean, we were changing activities. And she thought that was a great idea. And I said, God, please be part of our sexual activity. And it was wonderful. The whole business about placing someone else's welfare above your own is a great opportunity. And openly loving someone and not being embarrassed about sexual activity is, in my experience, is absolutely one of the best things that God ever created, right up there with green chili. So are you willing to take God's will into all your activities? And all, I mean all of them. Ask God to be a part of it. See what happens. See, we're encouraging you to do a lot of things you may not have considered. But But God's part of everything. And there are so many beautiful things in life. And if you're a fan, does anybody in here read Thomas Merton? Thomas Merton, in the book The New Seeds of Contemplation, makes a point out of saying we are given all these opportunities to absolutely enjoy life. And what God wants us to do is precisely that, or He wouldn't have given us all of those opportunities. So, you know, the book makes a real big deal out of prejudices. And I have prejudices about everything. I have prejudices that the church taught me. I have prejudices that I learned growing up. I have prejudices from the directions given to me by people I lived with, parents, foster parents, all this different stuff. And most of them don't hold the water. And what Thomas Merton said, Thomas Merton was a Trappist monk, a Cistercian, and was a very bright man. And he says, God gives us all this stuff. If you're not enjoying it, you missed the point. Life can be joyful, and if your life is anything other than that, you got too much bullshit in your head. And now is a good time to change your mind.